Greetings from the Southern Cohort of the 2019 UC Coro System-Wide Leadership Collaborative. Our cohort project is entitled Best Practices for Leading Campus and System-Wide Change Projects, and our deliverables include the production of podcast interviews with influential people in the area of change management, theory, and application. My name is Daniel Jeske, a professor of statistics and the Vice Provost of Administrative Resolution at the University of California at Riverside. I'm joined in this interview by three UCR cohort colleagues: Jacqueline Norman, the campus architect and assistant vice chancellor for planning, design, and construction; Andrew Laird-Smith, the campus ombuds; and Monica Carson, professor and chair of biomedical sciences. Our guest in this podcast is Kim Wilcox, the chancellor of the University of California at Riverside. Well, welcome, Chancellor Wilcox, to our podcast. We're pleased that you are willing to join us, and maybe we could start by having you tell us a little bit about your background and experience with change management.
I remember a few times in my career where I was thinking about new position, new opportunity, and either I had the conversation with the would-be supervisor, employer, or with my wife or somebody. And I usually found myself saying, I don't want to just run something. I want to go someplace where there's a chance to make a difference, evolve, grow, change, transform, some opportunity that way. So ever since I became a department chair, I guess, I've been managing change in one way or another, different stakes, different timelines, different constituencies.
Could it have started before that? Because I've heard you mention in a meeting that you grew up in a family that had a grocery store business.
Yeah. And
perhaps there was a lot of change in your experience.
Yes, Dan. My father dropped out of school in the sixth grade. At one time, he had four part-time jobs. And just as I was finishing junior high, moving to high school, my parents bought a grocery store up in the country. And so that became the family business. And you're right, change was all kinds of things. We bought with it a trailer park, so managing the washateria, laundromat that was part of the, there were lots of, change was pretty much constant.
Right. And maybe you saw a bit of what is referred to as the people side of change management with those experiences too. That's a little bit different than the technology part of change.
Yeah, of course, in a university, when we talk about change, it is almost never about a new sidewalk or a new tree. It's about a new process. It's a new set of relationships. The real change that is the most powerful and oftentimes the most vexing is how we act, what we do, the people. So the people management is really when I think of change management, is about people management and how you can best help people move through a change.
What are the characteristics of a senior leader that makes that person good at moving change through a system?
It's almost trite to say communication, but it is communication in large measure. The more time and expertise you have in communication, almost always the better off you'll be.
Monica wanted to know a little bit more about what communication means in the context of change management.
To follow up on one of the things you said it's trite, but I noticed the first thing you said is communication. And that is what everybody says, yet all of us struggle with what is communication.
First syllable of communication is co. Too often we think of communication as the chancellor sending out emails or having meetings or edicts. And yes, that's important, maybe the primary part of this, but recognizing the co part, and that's two-pronged. One, the responsibility of the others, that is, they shouldn't be idle recipients, but also the responsibility, I'll use myself in my case, as my responsibility to listen, not just preach. There's communicating the rationale or the need or the urgency or all three for some change. There's the communication about what change will be given that urgency and set of conditions, then why this option, then where we are in the process, then what happened after the process. So there's lots of different kinds of communication, and depending upon the change or the disruption, different parts need to be prioritized more.
The messaging might need to be different to different constituents also, right?
Yes. There are some changes that the faculty are really in favor of that the students don't want at all. So, yes, the message becomes quite different.
Right. Mia Walker gave interesting examples at the retreat about how you would craft emails to faculty that look a lot shorter and more to the point than might go up to other parts of the campus.
Another great point, Dan. So let's be as direct and as brief and concise and effective as we can. I love to claim that my background's in communication disorders. I could also use some analogies to child development, but I better not go there.
No.
In case the faculty are listening.
And they will be. Jacqueline switched the topic to the specific challenges in academia with respect to change management.
What would you say is different about change in higher education than, say, in the corporate world? And what does that imply for us when we have changes on a UC campus?
Well, the obvious one is the egalitarian of our society. We pride ourselves in the sense that we're all of equal and we all have a role in this decision-making process and the rest. We all struggle with what parts are ours at what time. Too often we find ourselves deciding that based on what the topic is and whether it's not of interest to me at that point in time. And that is a difficult reality to manage in terms of getting things done and holding people accountable. It seems to me you have to be clear about the domains where you have primacy. That's much simpler in a corporate world.
Is it stronger in the UC system, that balance, than it is because of our shared governance structure?
I think the lines are blurrier here. The primacy is still pretty clear, but we've blurred the line between consultation and decision-making in ways. And maybe that's good, but it is different from other places.
Yeah.
The more difficult, it's different, I guess I would say. One of the consequences is the difficulty of holding people accountable, because once you start to share the decision-making too far, it's hard to know who's at fault.
Who really made the decision.
Yeah, and why we made it, and what contributed to it, and the rest. So I wouldn't say better, worse, harder, but different in that regard.
How do you recognize when you need to engage in or ask for a change?
We had a retreat here last week. A lot of it focused on change. And there were readings ahead of time. And Christine, the associate chancellor, was in a couple days before saying she was going to say this to the group, that she could see me in the list. And she identified me as someone who does the analysis, compares with best practice, compares with opportunity, says, this is the right choice. And then just wants to go there, which is, can be seen as top down, I suppose, or could be seen as visionary leadership. I'll choose that option. Out of the two.
Maybe it depends how it works out.
Yeah, it depends how it works out. It depends on whether or not you want to go there too or not.
Yeah,
there's lots of variables in it. So anyway, I have lots of flaws, but one of them is this sense of, okay, let's get on with it. I spent a lot of time beforehand thinking about this. Some people, believe it or not, describe me as quiet, because an awful lot of time I'm not saying much. I'm trying to listen. That's where I'm doing my active work. And it doesn't look like it to some people, like I've been consulting or listening or doing enough. I seek out what I need. A lot of stuff comes to me, and then I kind of set the direction from there.
Andrew wanted to explore a little bit more the implications of distributed decision-making.
If I could follow up about your point about kind of diffuse decision-making, what implication does that have for change management?
It makes accountability more difficult. Mm-hmm. It also can confuse the consultation process. If we're in a consultation mode and I know that Dan's the decision maker, then what I say and what I do is different than if I think I get to make the decision or if we both get to make the decision.
Is your role in change management initiatives initiated by UCOP different when they are initiated on campus?
That is a very good question. It gets to the heart of what our roles are in the hierarchy. I don't know of any provost who is pleased to hear that a dean went to the chairs and said, well, the provost is making us do this, right? And I don't know of any dean who is glad to hear the chair went to the faculty and said, well, the dean said we had to do this. Granted, sometimes that is the case, but the extent to which we pit one level of the organization against another doesn't work for us, isn't in our collective best interest. Now, that's not to say I agree with everything the president's office wants to pursue, and I'm sure they don't agree with everything that we choose to pursue. But finding some way to make the end game and the process as much the same as we can, regardless of the decider or the direction, I think is healthy for the organization. It's harder if it's somebody else's decision than if it's yours to be all in.
What are those communication channels when you might actually be agreeing with the people?
I do sometimes say, look, the president's office says we have to do it. And I don't mean that to deflect the decision, but to just say, there's no sense us spending 6 months debating this. This is what we got to do. The president says we have to do this. Let's just do it. I love universities, but we do sometimes process a lot. I'd rather spend that processing energy on things that make a difference.
So I wonder if we could shift to this issue of resistance, recognizing and dealing with resistance to change.
An awful lot of what I think to be good decisions, I don't pursue at all. Once I've got a pretty good idea that either we have to do this or this is so important for us and our future, then I just try to push through, trying to find support. And almost everyone, even the most controversial changes that I've been involved with over my career, there is always an amazing amount of support out there. it almost always is quieter than the resistance. Even when the odds are 10 to 1 for or versus against, the negatives are always way louder than the positives. Once you get a sense of how important the decision is, where it's going to lead, what the price is, where the support is, then you just got to, sometimes you got to bear through. And often that's where I go is back to the beginning point of here's why I think we need to do this. That's a part that sometimes gets lost in this milieu of all these people and all their touches on the elephant. Almost always, I've got a graph in my hand.
A graph?
A graph of whatever it is. Dollars, people, or yeah, some kind of data is usually where I go.
Do you think that helps because, you know, when you're trying to communicate, people may not actually care about the graphs per se, but you're bringing something to the table.
I'm sitting here reflecting back at a time when I was department chair. I was in a meeting with the current chair of the department. I'm now the dean. So 3 years before, I was sitting in his chair. He's in the dean's office asking for money. And it was all good. And I said, Hugh, I just don't think we can do that. He was one of my best friends. And he said, Kim, you don't understand. And I said, Hugh, what do you think I don't understand? I had your job 3 years ago. I think I understand. The answer is no. and it made me think of, okay, how do I get in the other seat in a way that is so real? Oftentimes with the vice chancellor, I say, let's think about what this feels like in a department chair meeting, or a department meeting, rather. With all the faculty sitting around, what's this going to look like? I mean, there is a lot of value for me in trying to get my head in the other chair. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a part of this.
Walk a mile in my shoes,
yeah,
kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Part of my job.
We ask the chancellor if testing and training are two areas of change management that tend to be under-resourced.
I think training is also almost trite to say none of us were trained for these jobs. I think there is a lot more we can do there, but it also isn't comfortable in our culture. Mm-hmm. Requiring training of anybody in a university is hard. Particularly in the faculty side. Even deans and provosts and chancellors, I don't like to be required to go to training.
We've heard, in fact, from experts in the field of change management that training is a word that faculty don't like to hear. Training is for animals.
Yeah, exactly. And advanced education they already have. So what are you laughing at? But I will say this, that's the faculty cohort. We've got, depending on how you count them, 3,500 employees without students, 6,000 with only 850 or something are faculty. There's an awful lot of other people who are not only willing but actually eager for training. We have not been very good, I don't believe, at supervisory kinds of training. And I'm encouraged by the increasing number of faculty members, deans and chairs that are interested in improving their supervisory skills, which probably will move us ahead as far as many. So yeah, we can do a better job.
You've also talked about in this that you yourself were confronted with the need to do multiple changes simultaneously. When you're in the midst of it, you commit to these simultaneous. How do you manage these so that they're thriving? How do you keep track of them?
When we're in the middle of some kind of major institutional change, the majority of issues are dealt with somewhere else. The big ones end up on my desk. And by then, I can call up the key people. Sometimes we get them all together in a room and talk through how do we solve this problem.
We ask the chancellor to describe a particular change management experience at UCR where, in retrospect, things might have been done differently.
Let's use UC PATH as an example, which was a university-wide process change that we were a pilot.
First pilot.
Yeah. And I will tell you, I've said this to the president, we weren't a pilot. In my mind, a pilot is you run something, you stop, you reflect on something, you change it if it needs to be changed, you do it. This was just, we were in the first in the chute. That's different from being a pilot. We were a pilot. So we did what we thought was going to be appropriate in terms of reorganizing ourselves internally, thinking that that was the right thing from what we understood and were told from UC PATH. They start down the road. They just keep bringing people on. No time to reflect on us. You know, I'm not telling tales of school. I had told all the chancellors and the president in the same room. We've learned some things. Stop for a minute. Reflect. We can advise the next set of campuses on how to do this. By then, we were, I don't know how many hundred million dollars over budget. The board was impatient. The legislature and the auditor were on the university's backs. We had no choice but to keep rolling. So that was trying to move the mindset of the president's office and the president and the board and other people. While at the same time, you know, we had graduate students not getting paychecks. In the throes, what was most important was trying to get the problems fixed.
Do you think that it was rolled out too soon?
Yes. Yeah. If we had stopped after Riverside and spent 6 months reflecting, it would have given us time to reorganize ourselves, but but it would have let the other campuses know what things they could and couldn't do, what would have made sense. And as a result, we couldn't even reorganize ourselves because the central operation was so taxed by moving people on that we couldn't readjust our relationship with them because they didn't have the capacity to do that. So it hurt us all.
Under-resourced.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm wondering if that idea of using a smaller group as a true pilot and then pausing and reflecting and then thinking about broader is, you know, whether that could apply to campus level changes.
Thank you, Andrew. I was thinking the very same thing as you said that. The advantage of UC Path was it was discrete by campus. The chunks were pretty fine. I can't imagine how we could have done that with Banner, the student information system. We had to move everybody who gets financial aid onto the same system. Right. We had to move everybody who enrolls in class, which is pretty much everybody, onto the same system. So it would have been hard. We couldn't have done engineering, then business, and started with some smaller schools and moved up. I'm trying to think of other...
How about E-File Plus?
Could have done it there. Yep, that's a good example. I guess that's a kind of a level of analysis we haven't always brought to the task.
Now, there's some changes we have to commit to, like you're saying, because one of our systems is failing, so we have to move forward, and there's pressures that. Not all of our changes are that mandated. They are to improve, to change, for whatever reasons. So when we're thinking in that light, what are the signals that a proposed change should be reconsidered, terminated, readjusted?
I don't have a simple answer. At the end of the day, it becomes a calculation of ROI in some fashion or other. And for many of the things, that I'm involved with, the return is awfully hard to know because the return is 10 or 20 years out. CARB is a good example. There are faculty members who are frustrated that I gave away 19 acres of land. I'm convinced that those 19 acres will be well worth it 20 years from now. My vision is they're going to help. They won't be all, but they're going to help to redo the economy of the city. And that's an easy example of lots of other kinds of things. So hard to put analysis on it. And that's where I just have to kind of go with my gut at times, I guess, as much as anything.
Well, just to get you to say a little bit more on that, and that's because I think coming back to resistance that may be louder, maybe you can or cannot assess what the true positive-negative ratio is. But in these examples is, you know, how do you recognize, because you have made these decisions, ones that you have reconsidered or terminated and the ones that you go forward. So how are you making those discriminations?
I'm not trying to dodge the question. I don't have a simple answer because there's lots of things that I wish we could have done, but we haven't. In part because I didn't think we could pull it off. And in part because people, the resistance doesn't bother me so much, I'll be honest with you. And maybe that's a fault. But if I balked at all the resistance, we wouldn't get where we need to go. And I guess that's, and again, pro or con, you can decide. I tend to say, okay, this makes sense. This is where we should go. And I'm not going to go there bullheadedly, but I'm going to go there if I can, because I think it's what we need. And that's why I say all the time, that's why you hired me. Now, at some point, yeah, there's some people who still want to throw me out. I understand that. I'm well aware. It hurts, deeply hurts. But I get it. But I'm not going to not go there because I think some people don't want to go there. I'm not going to go there if it doesn't make sense. And if they can convince me it doesn't make sense. But if they just don't want to do it, I'm not. That's not enough for me. And that's, maybe it is bullheaded.
So I think that, coming back to that question, to just revisit the one question about, you have multiple changes going on. Knowing how you do this, you need to push these forward. Are there any other kind of strategies you could bring to bear, either people strategies, resources, to help when these too many balls in the air?
If we go back 5 years ago when we had all these things we had to do at once, we didn't have enough people. We also didn't have enough people to communicate about them. Managing change is not a word that appeals to me. Communicating, discussing, and processing change is a different kind of thing. I don't think you can manage a change. You got to do the change. You got to make the change. But we didn't have enough people in this building, let alone on the rest of the campus, to even have the right conversations to process and share and get the feedback and all that. There's the infrastructure was just so fragile.
Monica turned the conversation toward the challenges of navigating change in environments that have not had a lot of experience with change.
suggested that the group that we're dealing with here may not be as used to change. Is this something also to be considered when one's processing change?
I don't want to make it sound that negative. I think the world has changed a lot in 6 years I've been here. But back to things that surprised me, I was surprised at an earlier time about that. And it makes sense to me. It was a great university, still is a great university. And why disrupt that? Why move my cheese? And a lot of cheese would get moved all at once. I think that we're in an even better place now. I hope that some of the effort that was made in moving cheese now looks a little more worth it to people. It was also the depth of intransigence, I guess. Yeah, it surprised me. But again, I understand it given the history. Nothing had changed for a long time. I mean, we still were doing things the way we had done them 20 or 30 years before. So it wasn't a continuous improvement kind of environment. People weren't used to chancellors doing these things. People weren't used to provosts doing these things. And so all these things are new. And so you wouldn't be ready for things to change because they never had.
We have great faculty. We have amazing staff members. But you know, they're like, some of our staff members are like athletes. They're talented, but we never let them, never give them a chance to practice.
Yeah, we've got to empower them to do some stuff. And then, again, this kind of change management stuff, everybody should be changes. I mean, I should only have to come in and say, wait a minute, change too much here.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our...
I think I said way too much, too. this was all intended as a hoax. Very little of this is true.
Well, I think we can agree that whatever it was fire.
Oh, you watched the video!
Well, we appreciate your time. It's great to have you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
The music in this podcast is entitled The Fifth Life by Circus Marcus.